Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quinsey connecting the light. My guest today is Stephen Sindone. He's been with me before. We had a very interesting program talking about his adventures, I think that would be the right word to call them, in trying to track down the findings of a cave by J.C. Brown. This is a period going back to the very early 1800s. And he feels a very personal connection with this story. So we're going to hear about that and also about his movie, about his later ventures, trying to track down the cave once again. Anyway, Stephen will tell us all about that. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me on again on the program.
Perhaps you could start off by telling people what your background is, because not everybody, I guess, sets out in the world to go on the sort of adventures that you have, and sort of sounds rather exciting.
Well, it started out very young age where I realized that I might have had past life experiences before being here before, and as I started to feel the stronger and stronger, I realized that I needed to, as I got older, to put my pulse on this, because usually children are very in tune to these type of things, and then as they go to school, they kind of break them of their psychic intuitiveness. And I've been psychic intuitive from an early age, and when my grandfather passed on, I was able to tune into him and others who crossed over, and I started to get information. And then later on, I became sort of a psychic detective, where I would get information, be led to a book, mysteriously it would fall off a shelf and things like that. But the legend of J.C. Brown was one where I was looking to write a screenplay and read the story on the internet. It was out of an Emily A. Frank book, Mount Shasta, California's Mystic Mountain. And there was three pages I read, and I was intrigued by it. There were seven clues in it, and I decided I was going to spend 2 weeks in New York Public Library running down the clues and see if I could discover who the man was of the legend, if it was really a fact or it was fiction. And that's how my search began.
Right. So how long ago was it that you first started to get involved in this in a very real way? I mean, when did you sort of start your search?
Well, it started at December of 2007, and then January through March of 2008, I was able to run down the clues of the Lord Cowjay Mining Company. And by April, I had figured out who the man of the legend was. His name wasn't J.C. Brown. His real name was John Benjamin Boddy. And I started to then be able to figure out how things happened. I went to another library and got photos from a memoirs for Lord Cowjay, the mining company. And in the book, I found photos of three other engineers that worked for him in Mexico. Yeah. And there was one man, John Benjamin Boddy, who I looked at, and I just felt a strong connection to. So I researched Lord Cowjay. He had died in 1927, but the man who shows up in Stockton, California, in the office of the editor of the newspaper, shows up in 1934. So I realized it couldn't be Lord Cowjay, but reading the legend again, the man claimed that he was a lieutenant for the company, and he spent his whole life working for that company. So when I looked closely at the three men in those memoirs, I said, well, let me go and check the border crossings for these three men coming in from Mexico into the United States. And lo and behold, John Benjamin Boddy's border crossings coincided with the years 1903 to 1904, as the legend stated in the Emily A. Frank book. And upon realizing that, I looked closer, and I found Lord Cowjay himself coming in with John Benjamin Boddy three different times through Mexico, the Laredo-Texas border. And then I realized, this is more than a legend. I've got a bullseye. When I got the photo of John Benjamin Boddy, I looked at it, and someone said, Stephen, do you realize he looks just like you? And I go, well, you know, he looks like my father or my grandfather. They says, no, he looks like you. And at that point, Mike, I got goosebumps. So I said, well, you know what? Let me ask my higher self, Stephen, if this is you, how did you do it? How did you go up to Shasta? What were you doing up there? And how did you find this tunnel? Well, next thing you know, I'm getting led to different books, information. And what I got was that I was there on vacation with Lord Cowdrey at the Mount Shasta Springs Resort. And while we were walking the grounds, we saw an unusual rock basalt foundation. And we decided we were going to search and explore it. And on three different trips, I went back up there into this unusual rock basalt foundation under the bowels of Mount Shasta to find an ancient civilization. Now, when I realized that I was able to track this whole journey as though I had been there, I went up to California to actually go to find this location. And lo and behold, Mike, I went up to Mount Shasta in that area. I knew exactly where I was going, and I found what it was I was looking for as a result of it.
Yeah, would you put that down to intuition, or was it some sort of psychic experience?
I will put it basically to I went back to the scene of my time, and to finish the expedition, because in the legend, I felt that there were things that were just weren't solved, and I needed to know more about who this ancient civilization was under the Mount Shasta to figure out why I was so drawn in this lifetime to go back there. And I was able to figure that out, and by the end of this program, I will tell you, you know, what I learned as a result of me going back up there with my film crew to film this movie this past October.
Yeah. So, just going back to J.C. Brown, he apparently made his discovery, I believe, in 1904, and then the next reference to him is 1934, when he tried to arrange an expedition to the caves, and then it's history, of course. He never turned up on the morning, and he was never seen again. He just seemed to disappear out of sight. But what happened between 1904 and 1934? Because would one assume that he kept going back to the caves and maybe removed artifacts and things like that?
Well, yes, he did. He, through the border crossings that I found through Laredo, Texas, he had come in at least 13 times through Mexico in those years up to 1934. He had lived in Mexico building the Trans-Mississippi Railroad for the Lord Cowdrey Mining Company. And while they were there, they struck oil, and they created the Aguilar Oil Company. And he was very close to Porfirio Diaz, the president of Mexico. So they built a Trans-Mississippi Railroad that went across from the Pacific to the Gulf 12 years before the Panama Canal. And they beat the Americans to the trade through the Far East, using Mexico as the way to get the goods from the Far East to the United States. So he became very rich. He was worth about $40 million in 1915. So he was a very wealthy man, Mike. He was not someone who was just a prospector. He was a very prominent man from England.
No, I didn't know that, right. Because one might assume, which I think was suggested, that once he found this cave and realized what it contained, and there were clearly treasures in there that were worth a small fortune, he was dubious, I think, about announcing it to his employers, because he felt perhaps the find would then be classified as something that would pass over to them, because he found it when he was employed by them. So would that be a reasonable assumption, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. He decided he was going to wait until Lord Cowdrey himself passed away, and then he was retiring. So he went up there when he was in his 60s, making sure that it was in the later stages of his life, so that way he could stay claim to it at that time, because he didn't want it to go to anybody other than himself, because he was the one who actually made the find. And he was leery about sharing it, because he had been kidnapped once before going up to the Mount Shasta area. So he had to be very careful when he went up there in 1934, because he realized he went up there incognito. He stayed in a shelter up in Stockton, and he told people if people knew that I was worth millions of dollars, I wouldn't be alive today. So he was there making believe he was penniless, so to speak, and playing himself off to be J.C. Brown, who was really John Benjamin Boddy, as I mentioned earlier.
Yes, yes. Now, did he take any photographs inside the caves, and did these sort of come into the public domain? Because one would have thought that that's the sort of thing you would do.
Yes, he did. He took photos with the first Kodak camera that came out in those days. I guess they called it a Brownie model. And he had a vault in Laredo, Texas, where he kept some of the photos and other things that he had brought down back from Shasta. But one of the things you have to understand, Mike, is that he had to go across the border. And every time he went across the border, he had to be careful of what he brought back with him, because he was fearful of, of having somebody find out that he actually was removing artifacts from this ancient tunnel and civilization he found there. So he, on the third border crossing, which I found interesting, when they asked him if he had ever been in the United States, he lied and said no. So that was interesting that he did that, because I realized that he was nervous and leery about, you know, why do you keep coming back from Mexico into the United States? Why are you making so many trips back over the border? You know, what's your purpose? What is your reason? Because you are not a citizen of the United States. You are a citizen of England.
Absolutely. And I guess when people started to get suspicious, they may well have tracked his movements. And one has to think, if someone else, particularly if it went back, say, to the authorities or the government, might have stepped in and, in the end, removed him because he was really threatening to open it up to the public, and they didn't want that to happen.
Yeah, that is exactly right. What I got through my my meditation is that he was part of the secret societies, and he one of his friends was one of the Harrimans in New York. We put down as somebody who's going to visit on his manifest coming in from the United States. He came in passage on one of the ships from England into New York. So he was friends with the Harrimans and all the elite, and he probably told him and others in his secret organizations what he was about to do. And when you belong to secret societies, you take an oath, and I'm sure John did, but he just felt that this was something he wanted to share. But the secret societies say, no, we're going to make an example of you. They kidnapped him, and he just barely got away, you know, by the skin of his teeth. And being worth $40 million, Mike, it was not about money for John Benjamin. It was about the actual civilization. It was about showing the world that there is a civilization that had been here since the beginning of this planet's existence, and the powers that be would not allow him to share this information as a result of what it would do to the controllers who run this planet.
I can totally believe that, because there is evidence of that type of thing, so that's quite a reasonable conclusion, I think, taking into account all the circumstances. Now, when you spoke about a secret society, do you just mean something like the Freemasons, or is it something a little bit more secret?
Freemasons is exactly what I'm speaking of, yes.
Right. I didn't know, I mean, but I was just wondering what type of society was involved there. Yeah, so really, when you come to look at it, I suppose, from 1904, over those years up to 1934, he could hardly have expected to keep his secret to himself.
No, he did not. He tried, even he told his family about it, and some of his family members who wanted to go on an expedition started to die off mysteriously. One got into a car accident, so he realized that this was something that he did not want his family really to get involved with. But it's interesting, though, you know, fool's gold, so to speak. People who want to go after and chase the carrot or chase the gold find out that there are perils that you come into when you start looking for things that have been secret, or they want to be kept secret and not let out and be revealed. So these are things that he just knew that as his family started dying, that he realized that it's not worth pursuing any longer. He was an older gentleman at that time. And I guess he realized that he's not a cat. He doesn't have nine lives. So maybe it's good that he drops out of sight, which he did after 1934. And he spent the next 6 years of his life moving from England to Scotland. And he died in Scotland in 1940 in his sleep.
Really?
So,
oh,
yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. I sort of searched around, but I guess all I found is some very basic information. But am I correct in thinking, according to the reports, that the cave was in the Cascade Mountain Range of California? Is that correct?
Yes, he said the Cascade Mountain Range because that is where Mount Shasta and Dunsmuir and Weed, California, is located. But he didn't want to let the cat out of the bag. So when he talked about it, he called it the Cascade Mountain Ranges because he wanted people to go with him, but he didn't want them to know exactly where they were going.
I gather that the reason he found the cave was because a landslide apparently destroyed a rock wall that hid the tunnel entrance from view. Does that come out correctly, do you think?
No, what happened was they were all civil engineers. And being civil engineers, they looked at this unusual rock basalt foundation. And when you look at the wall, the columns are vertical, and it looks like a totem pole with different faces, which there are faces on these rocks. And when they saw it, you look at it, and it looked something abnormal. It looked something out of an Indiana Jones movie. So when they saw this, they knew they were standing in front of something that was ancient, and they wanted to check it out and dig it out. And that's what they did on consecutive visits up there. Other times when John Benjamin Biddy went across the border, he came across with three other civil engineers from the Lloyd Cowdrey Mining Company, and their names are listed on a manifest. So he went back up there with a team of explorers that were all civil engineers because they knew that was something that they were going to find there. So he just didn't happen up there to go up there by himself. He came back with other men. So when I started to see this develop, I realized that this was a concerted effort to be able to search and explore these tunnels. But you have to remember, this is America. He's British. He's coming to someone else's country, and somebody's going to find out what he's up to. So these are just some of the perils that he had to deal with in that day and time.
Right. Now, is it correct that the tunnels leading off from the caves were some sort of 11 miles long or something like that?
Well, where these two entrances were, these caves or tunnels are honeycombed going down, which lead underneath to Mount Shasta. So that whole area there is honeycombed with tunnels and caves that lead underneath the mountains. So most of California has tunnels, caves, and an underground system. So this is something that most people don't realize and they're not aware of. So there are many tunnels throughout the United States, which I'd like to share with you now if I can.
Right. That's interesting. But I gather that where J.C. Brown was concerned, though, his find was when he came to apparently a very large man-made cavern which had rooms, which was reported as having sheets of tempered copper, and that must have been quite something in itself. And from there he found all shields hanging on walls and saw unusual artifacts and statuettes. And I think I remember reading that he even came across mummies. So tell us what he found there, if that information is correct.
Well, yes, he found artifacts that appeared to be Egyptian or Sumerian or ancient cultures. He found weaponry that we can't even make today. He found chambers that were places of worship. And then he found a room that had 27 skeletons of mummies that were 7 to 10 feet tall. So here is, he finds the remains of larger beings, and also he found the mummified, which he believed was a king and queen of that culture, which he thought may be Lemurian. So here we're talking about civilization that predates civilizations as we know it. And so he was excited about what he had found. And when he was there, in one of the rooms he went into, because there was round houses there, he called it a village with streets and lights. He said that it appeared that when they got there, that everything was thrown about as though someone must have realized they were coming, and all of a sudden it was just deserted. So there probably were inhabitants at that time there that he happened upon, and when they probably heard him and his party coming, they all took to the tunnels and left, so that way he would only find the little village and the rooms and the artifacts that I mentioned.
Is it correct, perhaps, to assume, in view of the fact that these people that inhabited the caves were of some old race, and as far as we know, Atlantis finally submerged around about 10,000, perhaps 12,000 years ago, that these people must have left the caves at about that time, and perhaps it may have been due to the floods or something of that nature?
Well, from my further research in that, I believe the people that he happened upon were of the Anunnaki from the planet Nibiru, and they were the ones who went into the hollow earth at the time of the deluge with the flood of Noah. So this all can be found. If you research Zachariah Sitchin's 12th planet, a lot of what is you can find there dovetails with the story of the hollow earth and what happened after the deluge, where the Anunnaki went and where they still are today underneath Mount Shasta and other mountains, as I learned later on by going up there.
Well, that's an interesting thought, because the Anunnaki appear very much in the Sumerian stories. They don't go back possibly as far as Atlantean times, but the Anunnaki were certainly very active, and I believe also there's a suggestion that they also appeared in Egypt. So,
Yes, Mike. The Anunnaki were the Egyptians, they were the Sumerians, and they were cultures all over the world. If you understand the fact that 400,000 years ago, the Anunnaki were having problems on their planet, and Alulu came here to search for gold, and they were going to use the gold to put it around their atmosphere. Probably it was holes in their atmosphere. And he radios back his planet and lets them know that there is gold here on the earth. They send an exhibition party down here about 445,000 years ago, and his grandson, Enki, was the lead scientist who came, and they found that they could mine gold in Mesopotamia in the Middle East there. But then they realized that there was more gold in the Abzu, or they call that in South Africa. So they then started mining in South Africa. This goes 450,000 to 300,000 years ago. But there was a revolt at 300,000 years ago where the Anunnaki spacemen or astronauts who were working the mines said, you know, this is enough. We need somebody else to mine these mines there in Africa. So what was decided, there was at that time Neanderthals on the earth, and Enki decided that they were going to create a test tube experiment whereby they can create in their image a slave worker to work the mines in South Africa to relieve the Anunnaki workers, so that way these primitive workers in their image could mine the gold mines.
Right. Do you think then the present African tribes may well have been some of those very same, or originated from those same slaves that they sort of engineered, as you might say?
Yes, because what happened was from there, they then took, they called them the Lulu, so to speak, and they took them to the Garden of Eden in Mesopotamia, and Adam and Eve were black, and they worked in the garden. And the story from there is that they could not procreate, so they had to have another experiment to have them be able to procreate so that way they can copulate. So the second experiment was done, and at that time, they then were able to conceive. And at that point, it says, okay, now we're going to take you out of the garden, and we're going to populate the earth, is what they did. So Enki was a scientist. Nirhiseg was his scientist assistant, and with his son, Nigajita, another scientist, they were the ones to orchestrate early man on this planet. And this was 300,000 years ago that this all happened.
Yes, I'm sort of familiar with some of the stories. Now, Enki had a brother called Enlil. Wasn't he the one who seemed to have more, if you like, sympathy for the slave races produced, and then worked in his own way to make their life a little bit better?
It was backwards. Enki, who the scientist on Earth, he was in love with his experiment, the human, and his brother Enlil, who was in line for the throne on Nibiru, he was mad at the fact that once they created this human in their image, the Anunnaki themselves started to have sex with the offspring, and that caused many, many problems because these people were of giant size, and it made it difficult, and the child that were produced were hideous looking. And Enlil, the brother who was on the home planet, was mad at his other brother Enki for going ahead and copulating with the slave laborers. So it came to a point where these two brothers were feuding, and it was decided that Enlil had enough of the Lulus, or the first earthlings, and they were going to flood the earth. And once they flooded the earth, everything would perish. So it was decided that Enlil would flood the earth, and he told all the Anunnaki who were here to leave the earth in spaceships, and they watched as the earth got flooded. But one of the things that he did not know was that his brother Enki was going to groom Noah to be able to save the remnants of his experiment on the earth. So when the water subsided, Enlil came back down, surprised to see Noah and the ark and Enki. What's going on here? And what he found out was that Noah was really Enki's son. So he couldn't get that upset, because Enki copulated again with the earthlings to create Noah. So he says, look, he's half Anunnaki. So because of that, Enlil gave him a pass and says, well, I guess it's God's will. I think it's time now that we help the planet. No more slave labor. We now teach them to farm, agriculture, give them businesses, give them governments. So what they did at that point, they set up governments. All of a sudden, you've got the Egyptian civilizations, you've got the Sumerian civilizations, and these were Anunnaki civilizations that sprung up after that flood. So this is what happened when all of a sudden Earth got civilized, because if humanity and if the evolution had continued in the way that it was going, we would probably have a few million more years to wait before man ever evolved to the stage that we are at right now.
Right, yes. Now, just getting back to these giant-sized mummies, I gather they were probably up to about 10 foot tall. And it's interesting, in and around California, I've read many different stories of giant-sized skeletons being discovered, although I don't think it was helped at one time by someone faking a skeleton, which, of course, always makes people suspicious then of genuine finds. Have you found that yourself, that there's been a lot of evidence about these giant skeletons?
Oh, absolutely. Before the early settlers, before they went west and they made their way as far as Ohio, in Ohio they found mammoths and prehistoric creatures that were still roaming the state of Ohio. And this was in the early 1800s. So it boggles the mind what was still here on this continent in the early 1800s that you're not aware of.
I did read a story. I don't know if it's directly connected with John Brown's discoveries of skeletons being found that were clad in what was described as rough, oddly forged armor. Some wore helmets, and there were some who still had a trace of long reddish hair, which I've read before could be associated certainly with the Atlanteans. And he said some of the skeletons were carrying some kind of medals which were embossed in strange writing. And around the neck of each skeleton was an ornament of gold. Now, does that sound like the same mummies that he found?
Absolutely. You have to know that in those days, mummies, kings, and people of nobility were all adorned with those sort of attire upon their burial. So this was the way they dressed in those days. I guess in the United States they called it bling. They they had all their gold and all their all their glitter there to behold, because these were elite members of their societies at that time.
Right. Yes. Speaking of these giants that had some traces of reddish hair, that interested me because I know there are some old Indian legends that spoke of a race of giants with red hair. So that's got to be unusual.
Well, that's exactly right. The Native Americans have a number of different stories, not only the red hair men, but there was blue men that they discovered in Kentucky. There was a race of blue men that were there that they fought off in Kentucky, and they thought they killed them off. But they didn't. They went into a mammoth cave there in Kentucky and went back into the inner earth.
Right. Now, you're talking of not blue hair, of course, presumably blue-skinned.
Blue skin, yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting as well. I mean, not to get off the subject, but I have also read of ETs contacting people, and apparently there is one race of ETs, I don't know where they come from, that has blue skins, strangely enough. That's an interesting subject. excuse me, I need to have a cough. That's it, that's better. I was getting a little bit choked up then, I needed a cough. Now, I gather that at one time John Brown was found to have taken a circlet from the, I assume it was a gold circlet, from the caves, and that he also had a map, which I think he produced or was going to produce when he organized the expedition in 1934. So presumably those types of things have vanished without trace.
That's exactly right. He was to produce that the morning of June 19th, 1934, the morning of the expedition. But something spooked him at that time where he just did not show up at the Stockton Harbor, where 80 people waited in vain. But the 80 people had been sitting having meetings for 6 weeks at John Root's home there and in Stockton, and they believed that J.C. Brown, or alias John Benjamin Body, was definitely telling them the truth. They believed that this old-timer did find these ancient civilization in the Cascade Mountain Range.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I read that makes me feel he was completely genuine was that apparently he didn't take any money for this venture. Otherwise, people might have thought he was simply out to con people for their money.
That's exactly right. I think he borrowed $5 one day in a homeless shelter that he was staying in Stockton. And so he did a very good job of being incognito. Because being worth $40 million at that time, probably today we're talking about $400 million, if not more, maybe $1 billion in today's monetary world. So here's a man who is very, very wealthy. Lord Cowdray, when he died in 1927, was worth $350 million in those days. And so these were two very wealthy gentlemen involved in this legend.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I don't want to get off the subject too far, but what we're talking about has, for me, some connection also with a cave that was found in the Grand Canyon not too long back, which also allegedly contained Atlantean artifacts and things like that. But apparently once the authorities got to hear of it, they prohibited people from going into that area, and presumably they've just sort of taken it over, and whatever information they've got from the caves, they kept to themselves. Now, is that a story that you've heard about?
Oh, absolutely. I've heard that story and more. I can give you some interesting research material. It was an article written in the summer of 1978 in Pursuit magazine by a Dr. Anjard. He claimed to have knowledge of 44 underground cities beneath the surface of North America, six of them being on the West Coast, in California, in those areas. So there are similar, you know, sites all over the United States, as well as South America and Central America, where you've got ancient tunnels and civilizations that are hiding in plain sight.
It just seems such a shame that people take it upon themselves to keep our true history from us, because when we hear about it, I feel quite excited by it, to think that we've got ancestry like that, and that we weren't necessarily natives wearing a loincloth and coming out of the sort of woods with a club in our hand. I mean, quite clearly, going back many thousands of years, there was a very intelligent, advanced civilization on the planet.
That is very, very true. You know, as I mentioned, 44 states have a possibility of hollow earth tunnels in the United States. And the world entrances, you have Afghanistan, Central Asia, Tibet, Brazil has locations, Canada has their stories. In England, you've got a number in England, India, and Turkey, and I can go on and on, where there are many entrances that lead into the hollows of the earth throughout the world. So you just have to look, and if you do your homework, you do your research, seek and you shall find. So it is out there. I mean, I can tell you through my research that when I started to find out these things, I started to shake my head, because I put myself in danger in the fact that I was finding information out that people didn't want me to be privy to.
I'm not surprised. I've also read, I mean, again, it's sort of connected with the subject, talking about tunnels, but apparently there are massive tunnel complexes, even from one country to another, going under the sea. And it's quite interesting to me that they often find that these tunnels are not dug out in what appears to be the normal fashion, but all the sides of the tunnels are glazed, as though there's been something like a laser beam is just being used to sort of cut the way through the earth.
That's exactly right. I'll give you another one for you that the audience may can look up if they can find it. It'd be great.
Yes.
The Trans-Antarctic Mountain Range in Antarctica has two entrances, and for those who have a pencil, they can write it down and look it up.
Yes.
It's 66.603530 latitude, longitude 99.719853. This is an Antarctica hollow earth entrance with a face on the entrance, which is 16,000 feet up on the Trans-Antarctic Mountain Range in Antarctica. And 5 miles from that opening, there's another opening into the hollow earth, latitude 66.553280, longitude 99.839330. And these entrances were found by Dr. Edward Thiel, who was murdered in 1961 when he was there surveying these mountain ranges for the United States. So there's an unsolved mystery as part of this. If you try to Google these coordinates, it may be very difficult. You could probably try MSN to Google them to see if you can get a bearing on them. But I challenge anyone to go ahead and look for this, and what they'll find out is there is a concerted effort to stop the people of the world to know that there is a civilization that is more highly advanced than we are, that is coming and going through these entrances and others throughout the mountains without our knowing. They're able to dematerialize so we can't see them. They're able to cloud themselves, cover themselves in lenticular clouds. And I can tell you firsthand, being in California, I've seen lenticular ships, cloud ships in Mount Shasta. I've seen them in Mount Adams. I've seen them up in the state of Washington. They do exist, and aliens are among us. And I can tell you firsthand, I've been in the I prayed with Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest in the sweat lodges. And while in sweat lodges in deep meditation, I had visitations from grays that tried to penetrate my meditation. And at that point, I excused myself and I left the sweat lodge. And I stopped sweating that day because I realized that the grays were now interested in what Stephen Sandoni was trying to find out. So they do exist. They are here, and they're more than Anunnaki who are inside of the bowels of the earth. There is a civilization there that would boggle the mind as to how many people actually live in the hollows of the earth. You can look, check stories out, The Smoky God, and you can see what Olaf Jansen and his father discovered when they spent 2 years in the hollow earth with the inhabitants of the inner earth, who have their own king of the world there. And even in Tibet, they talk about these stories. So these legends are more than legends. The Native Americans, when the flood happened, they were taken inside of the earth by what they call the ant people, which through my meditated going deep, I realized the ant people they were referring to or trying to describe were really the grays. So the Native Americans know, and they will only go to the tree line up on the mountains. They will go no higher than the tree lines because they know who are inside of these mountains and who some of these beings are, because some of them are not benevolent. And so through my travels in Mount Shasta, I was able to learn a lot of this. And I guess, Mike, because of my reincarnation, coming back to the scene of my time, revisiting where J.C. Brown or John Benjamin Body visited, I know now what my purpose was, because I needed to know who lived in these mountains, who these people were. Were they Lemurian? Were they Anunnaki? Who they were? And now I know.
Yes, that's very interesting. What do you think, then, of Admiral Byrd and his experience entering the Hollow Earth through the pole?
Right. The latitude and longitudes I gave you were where Byrd went in on the South Pole. He went in, and that's where he went on the South Pole. There was a battle in one of those entrances because the United States wanted to get in there because they thought the Germans had went in after World War II into the Hollow Earth. So when they tried to enter one of these two openings I gave you coordinates for, we lost about 40 planes. We lost ships. There was a lot of big losses for the United States. They lost a battle for the inner earth. They tried to battle these people, and they ended up losing a lot of lives in it, but you'll never hear about that, and that's why the secret has been kept. If you look at Antarctica, no country can colonize Antarctica. Why? Because they want to keep the secret. So everybody knows, all these leaders know that there's something lurking in these two coordinates I gave you in the Trans-Antarctic Mountain Range, because there is civilizations that are in the hollows of the earth, and they come and go to Antarctica. And if we took an expedition there, as well as to Baffin Bay up on the north and on the North Pole, they would realize that everything that I say is right on point.
Yes, I do remember reading about the German expedition that was sent out, I think, by Hitler to try and find the entrance. Now, do you think the fact that, I gather, planes or aircraft are not allowed to fly over the poles is the very reason that if you did, you would actually realize that it was hollow and there was an entrance there?
Well, there's been photos, Mike, in 1968 that were taken by NASA that I put out there on one of my videos, Hollow Earth Revealed, that showed that there's a very big hole there. A friend of mine went to the Denver Museum, and they had photos in the museum there that showed a Hollow Earth entrance on the South Pole that they didn't realize that they had put out there on a globe that was out. So, yes, the entrances are there. They can be seen. And if you tried to go there, if you tried to fly over the poles, they would shoot your plane down. You would not get close to it. If you did get close to it, your compasses would go crazy because there is no North Pole or South Pole, and you would kind of get lost. And what would happen is you would end up be flying inside of the Earth rather than over it or across it. Yeah. So this is a very concerted effort to keep this from the public. I'll give you one last tidbit here. In the North Pole area, there are 12 rivers that come out from the inner Earth that converge to the outer Earth, and they're all fresh water. How can you have all fresh water icebergs and no salt water? Scientists have never explained that.
It's amazing what information is there if you really take an interest in it. It certainly is a subject that's been one I've been fascinated by. And when you turn up these facts, as you and I are discussing, it's really almost too difficult to believe that it's true because of the prohibition, I was going to say, it's not the right word, but because of all the efforts to try and keep all this information secret, you think, well, surely if this were true, we would have known a lot about it before now. But I think the people that cover it up have been pretty clever in doing that type of job. Now, unless you've got something to add to what we were speaking about John Brown himself and what he found. What about your movie now?
Well, my movie right now, I'm trying to get funding for it so that way I can get it out to film festivals. So if people want to go to my site, stevensandoni.webs.com, I'll have a link there which will take them to kickstarter.com where they'd be able to help fund the movie. And by pledging money to the funding of it, then I'll give them gifts based on, you know, their contribution to help fund this movie. So I'm looking for investors to help this project get along. So this is something that takes money to get these things out in Hollywood. I'm an independent filmmaker, so I need all the help that I can get to get this out there. We've got the film crew that has to get paid. So everybody, you know, worked on a deferred payment, and they were nice enough to do that. And I really want to get this movie out. So that's one of the reasons, Mike, I wanted to come on with you today to tell the story, to tell the complete story, and let people know that the things I say are true. The movie itself shows things in the movie that I found while I was out there. And there were other things I could have found, Mike, but I was under surveillance. Police were harassing me. There were attempts on my life. They tried to steal my luggage, people taking photographs of me, my computer was hacked. So these things don't happen, Mike, unless you're onto something. So what I realized was that if I'm going to go out and do another expedition, I will be taking another entourage with me because I realized that I cannot travel alone just with my shadow going forward.
Right. So what will your movie largely comprise of then? Will you do a sort of background information such as we've discussed about your feelings about being perhaps the reincarnation of John Brown and what you found out? And then will it also include information about one of your more recent searches? And are you going to mount another search? I mean, where have you reached in your travels?
Well, right now, the movie based on storyline in the movie based on reincarnation with me and my partner coming back to the scene of our time. And as a result of that, I have interviews of people in the area. One gentleman actually got to see a Lemurian who came out of one of the entrances that I talk about in the J.C. Brown legend, really? Who I interviewed in the movie, and he's become a friend. And we're probably going to get sonar equipment and to go back out to certain areas on the West Coast to be able to see what's underneath the ground, because we realize there's a lot more out there, and with the sonar equipment, we'll be able to figure out where these underground passages are, because they're in California alone. There are four rivers underneath California that lead out to the ocean, massive rivers. So there is hollowed caverns throughout the West Coast and other states. So this might be my future endeavor, but it's going to take money to do that. But I'd like to get this movie out to realize to people that, yes, not only did I talk about the information from the legend, I went out there and actually found two of the caves from J.C. Brown's legend. One of the caves, which I didn't have in the movie, what they did was they cut all the trees down where the X marks the spot, and they bulldozed all the trees out of the way, and they concealed the one entrance. So in the movie, I show the other caves that I went to. It was interesting that when I was up there searching for it in 2009 or 10, that they were bulldozing all the trees exactly in the area where I was going to look. So there is an effort, a big effort, to keep this secret. In that area, there's a military base on the back end of Mount Shasta on the McLeod side of the mountain that is underneath this mountain. So the military is there. There's a presence, and people see strange things, things going in and out of the mountain. So I have to tell you that these things do exist, and I am going to try to bring out this legend and other legends as we go forward to show people that these aren't myths, these aren't legends, this is reality.
Well, it's certainly a massive subject that will no doubt give you many, many options of what you can do on another sort of search, and I think it's a wonderful idea. Now, you're talking of getting funding for the movie, so you did give us your website address, but it might be a good idea if you give it again in case people didn't get an opportunity to write it down.
Okay, it's Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Sindoni, S-I-N-D-O-N-I dot W-E-B-S-webs.com. There's also another site I have, hollowearth.webs.com. So they can go there. If they want to see conspiracy, they can go to whatthefug.webs.com, and they can learn about the dysfunctional things that are happening in America as well that I've researched as well. For anyone who wants to know more about me, they can simply Google search my name, Stephen Sindoni, and I've got over 500 videos on YouTube, Daily Motion, and other websites, so I'm easy to find. Just plug my name in, Stephen Sindoni, and all that information will easily appear.
Right. Did you say then that you had videos on YouTube already?
Yes, I have them on YouTube.com on Webflix Guy, WebFlixGuy, and I also have videos on Sindoni Productions on YouTube, and on Daily Motion, I have them on Webflix Guy. So those three sites, there's probably 14 videos combined that they can watch videos on topics from A to Z, Hollow Earth, conspiracy, spirituality, and interviews that I've done in the last 5 years regarding this legend and other Hollow Earth endeavors.
Very good. It's very nice that people like you exist that aren't put off by the possibility that people will be watching you and tracking you and trying to get in your way to stop you achieving what you are looking for. So I admire your courage in going ahead. So I hope you get the support that you're looking for.
I hope so too, Mike. In January 24th, there was an attempt on my life. And fortunately, I was able to go to a homeopathic doctor and diagnose the symptoms, but I'm lucky to be here today. And I will just say, there for the grace of God go I. So I know that I'm onto something, but God loves me, Mike. And because I'm a co-creator with God, I will be around until I decide it's over when I say it's over. So I just felt today it would be important that I share this with you to let you and the listeners know that I do know a great deal about our civilization, because if you don't know where you've been, then how do you know where you're going?
Yeah, very, very good point you've made there. Yeah, well, it's been very, very interesting speaking with you, Steve, and I'm sure you've given people such information that they will certainly like to follow this through. I think it's a terribly interesting subject, and I'm sure if you delve around far enough, you can pick up a little bit more information. I think it's the other links to it that are interesting as well. As you said, there are tunnels all over the place, probably throughout the whole of the world. So if you can actually pick up a link to perhaps other explorers and what they've found, it could be a very fascinating subject. I think I need to thank you now for coming onto the programme, Stephen. I can't think of anything else that I wanted to mention that I haven't already done so. So thank you very much for coming on.
Well, Michael, thank you very much. And as always, it's always a pleasure to interview with you. You're one of my favorite hosts to come on with. I guess it's because of my Scottish ancestry. I feel like we're kin.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a fascinating subject that I've always liked. For years and years, I've always been fascinated by these type of stories. And I'm not satisfied in hearing the stories. Then I want to know all the ins and outs of it, which is probably why you are who you are, because you want to delve into it, you want to know more, and well, it's great. Yeah, thank you very much for your kind comments there. Wish you every success, and I hope you get the support you're looking for.
Michael, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, yes, who knows? We may be getting together in the very near future because you found something else to talk about.
Oh, absolutely.
I hope, anyway.
I've got a great deal. I've got a great deal to share with you. And today was just the beginning of the rabbit hole we've just endeavored down.
Who knows? Yes. Well, thank you, Stephen. Very, very nice to speak to you again.
Thank you, Mike.
Nice to have Stephen back because it's a very interesting story, even if you heard about it before. I think it's nice for it to come up again and just sort of refresh your memory as to how exciting our real history is. And what a shame that the authorities go to so much trouble to keep these sort of things quiet. Now, next week, I've got an author, William Whitecloud, coming on. He's written a book called The Last Shaman, and it's in the form of a novel. But I very much suspect a lot of it is based on his own knowledge and even experience. It's placed in Africa, and it's about the shaman magic that features in the story and what they can do, like shape-shifting and that type of thing. So if you don't know much about shamans, and I didn't, it's a very intriguing story. So I have to thank you for being with me today and hope you can make it next week. Thank you all. God bless you.